Welcome to Dithering on the Edge of Europe, the podcast about what it feels like to live in the UK and be on the edge of what's of Europe, of climate catastrophe, epidemics, pandemics, you name it.
I'm Rich McCarthy, ex-teacher, ex-energy auditor and real-life dad and house husband, it says here. That's because I really do have a son, apparently, and really do have a wife, and I live in a house.
Right, so you're commenting on my creative writing skills here.
No, not at all.
I am Carola Böhm. It says here, European, German wife. I'm also a mother. I'm also an academic, and I'm living here in the UK.
And she's real, everybody.
So did you feel this week that you are living on the edge?
I didn't feel so much on the edge as...
Of Europe.
Of Europe. Felt more on the edge of London, perhaps.
Well, maybe on the edge of...
Or outside the edge of London.
Or on the edge towards the next wave of COVID-19.
We'll all be more aware of that maybe after tonight.
Yes, because it's 4th of July.
It's Super Saturday.
The pubs have opened, or some of the pubs have opened. We just talked recently to a pub owner, and they basically said, no, they're just going to continue delivering their pub in the boxes.
And pubs weren't allowed to open until 6 o'clock this morning, apparently. I don't know how many people want to go to the pub at 6 o'clock, but it was to prevent pubs from opening 12 o'clock midnight, because that would make everybody crazy coming to the pub at midnight on a Friday to Saturday. But sure, tonight they'll all be sort of, oh yes, I can just take one beer and then I'll leave and I won't kiss or hug anybody on the way in or on the way out.
Super Hopefully. Saturday. That's us today, and we're recording on Super Saturday, and we're actually very fittingly talking about the three last, I don't want to say pillars, but the last
elements
of the Green New Deal, of the Green Party of England and Wales. We of course, last episode, we covered energy, housing and transport, and now fittingly, we're going to cover industry, forestry and farming, and income.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so who's going to go first?
So we've always said that as we come out of lockdown, we want to move into a green economy. And of course, you know, the Green New Deals are the best thing to interrogate and scrutinize in relation to what are the ways forward to move into a green economy and out of lockdown.
That was a very long-winded intro, but...
It's going to be long-winded, the recovery.
And we need to think in a long-winded way about things. In a long-winded way, yes. Yes, I suppose so, because you've got to think about how to do that rather than just jump in and say, build, build, build.
As we heard this week.
So this is the industry section of the Green New Deal, of the Green Party's Green New Deal.
And they called it industry. They headed it with the term industry rather... then what would naturally come into my mind, economy.
That's because you're German. Because Germans assume...
You've told me that before.
That's right, yeah. But you said it in the beginning that you're German. But that's how I know. Because Germans do produce an awful lot. They manufacture an awful lot. So a lot of the German economy, I presume, I haven't studied it or anything, is based around manufacturing and industry. Whereas we base a lot of our economy around...
Service industry.
Service industries, dealing banking, with money, banking, sector. Exactly.
Right. So the conscious decision to use the header industry rather than economy is a conscious emphasis on manufacturing rather than the service industry.
Yeah, it's saying, what are we going to do about industry?
And of course, that fits because... if we do move into a green economy, you know, we last episode we talked about the retrofitting that needs to happen and at a gigantic scale. That is all within the manufacturing industry.
Oh, the retrofitting on the houses would be to a certain extent, yes, because of manufacturing the...
materials.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. But, you know, it just fits because what we need to do, as we discussed last time, is develop the renewable energy systems, you know, whether that's windmills or hydro or...
Yeah.
That's all manufacturing.
Mm-hmm.
We need to do the gigantic retrofitting and the building of houses to passive house standard.
There's an element of manufacturing involved in that. So building, as you were saying before, making the materials.
So is this focus on manufacturing? Well, it has to come out of this notion of wanting to move into a green economy. And in this manifesto, so in this Green New Deal, it also suggests that UK needs to establish itself as a leader in UK-based manufacturing for renewable energy infrastructure. Is that not too much an ask?
I think for renewable energy infrastructure, we need things like our electrical grid has to be changed, because the way the grid works at the moment, it relies on big producers like nuclear power stations to stabilize the whole grid system.
Right.
And I don't understand it, to be completely honest, but we need to have a different grid which doesn't rely on that.
Maybe we should have a power engineer expert.
It would be brilliant if we had a wind power expert or a power expert. That would be fabulous.
Because we feel both of out of our depth there.
Oh, we're completely ignorant, aren't we?
Yes, okay.
Let's be honest.
So that's going to be on our list. Maybe we're going to get a power engineer in renewable energies.
Mm. Yeah, that would be good.
That we might be able to interview.
There is a lot of work to be done in that field, as is felt all over the world. So grids all over the world are thinking, if we're switching to renewables, we've got to change stuff on the grid. That has to be done.
Right. And then what is mentioned here as well, and we've already talked about the training that is needed to be able to service the renewable energy sector. And what is interesting in this manifesto, in this Green New Deal, is the suggestion that local authorities have to be given the power to direct training programs, with national government providing the funding. And, you know, it's part of this whole trajectory of decentralizing decision making. You know, we've got a highly centralized government structure, and that doesn't do us well. You know, in the COVID crisis, it has shown we're so centralistic that actually our local authorities can't actually act. They don't get the data. They don't get the
funding. They don't get anything.
So I like it that it's explicitly mentioned here in the section of industry that local authorities need to have the power to decide what training programs are needed. And they can then work together with the universities to make that happen, or the colleges to make that happen.
Because if you're a local authority on the coast and you've got a huge space for wind farms that's being used or not yet used or whatever, then obviously you could train people hugely to do with wind farms, whereas we don't have very many wind farms around us where we are. And the scope that we have is only for land wind farms, which is much smaller, and we're in quite built-up areas and so on. So there isn't so much scope for that for us. So we would train people in other areas.
And it also mentions a slightly different topic, ban single-use plastics, which is in the industry section, I assume because we need to create an industry sector which allows us, which deals with the fact that we have to move towards getting rid of any kind of single-use plastics.
Yeah, I think, and largely single-use plastics are used in packaging. So packaging that comes from directly from the producer. So the industry has to change that and not package with single-use plastics.
So why do you think, when they devised this Green New Deal, haven't they made mention of specifically the circular economy?
Yeah, they do mention the circular economy. Under the industry section, it says new technologies and circular economy. So the circular economy would be encouraged by boosting the repair and reconditioning sector, and they would also have apprenticeships for that. They wanted to develop the infrastructure to recycle nearly 100%. They would have the 10-year warranties on white goods and TVs and things.
Because the circular economy would then inherently have a much more green waste strategy built into that. And we've seen a video, I don't know if you've seen it, of this new company in London, actually, which is a lighting company, but they've moved completely to a circular economy. They don't sell you light bulbs. They rent to you the service of their light bulbs. So the light bulbs stay in their ownership, and they make a contract with you as a business to replace the light bulbs, let's say, every 5 years. But they come in and they manufacture light bulbs, and they have a service of making sure that you have light.
So do they recycle all the glass and stuff
so they
like that?
Exactly. So that goes in back into their production process.
Wow. Okay. That sounds great.
And those kind of models, I just think, are just absolutely inspiring.
It used to be like that for TVs. You used to
Exactly.
A lot of people, you know, we rented a TV for ages and...
Yeah. Now, what we don't know is at that point, probably recycling didn't happen as much. Or maybe it did, but maybe it didn't. Whereas with these models, of course, the recycling is built into the manufacturing process so that you feed back in the glass into the right place and you make the next generation of light bulbs.
Well, that's great. But then that would require the manufacture to happen here rather than in China or something like that, because otherwise you're shifting things all over the planet just to get them back to the source.
But that's also part of the Green New Deal.
Yeah, of course. You touched on switching models of ownership away from ownership to usership, which is like the light bulb company. And people always think about car sharing platforms. But also things like having a tool library would be brilliant. You know, imagine if we could... say, oh, we want to do this in the garden.
Yes.
We're just going to the library and we're going to rent out a fork and a rake and a blah, 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 or just borrow these things for the week and then we'll get the garden the way we want it to be and then we'll return them next week. That also...
But that's not in the Green New Deal. It doesn't specify the library use as such.
It doesn't specify library use, but it does talk about reuse of tools and things like that. Okay, next one is food, forestry and farming. And here, there is a big idea to refocus farm subsidies. It does mention subsidies, and I think farmers would be, you shouldn't call it subsidies, perhaps. And maybe we should not use the word subsidies.
Yeah,
but anyway, the money that goes to farms from the government so that it pushes more sustainable, diverse and environmentally friendly forms of farming.
Like organic farming. Maybe agroforestry. They mention actually agroforestry.
Yeah, they want to go for 50% agroforestry, which is...
Which is a lot because we don't do any at the moment.
We do a small amount. So
where do we do agroforestry?
I have seen an example of a farmer who grows fruit trees in between his plantations of wheat and it improves the crop.
So in a nutshell, tell me what agroforestry is.
Agroforestry is where you grow trees in with other crops.
So you have different layers of plants. You know, the lowest layer might be salads, then there might be bushes, and then there might be apple trees.
Yes.
But it does mean that we would phase out intensive livestock farming.
Yes, because that tends to be the source of a lot of pollution.
And of course, you know, farmers would actually say then we can't produce the amount of meat or the amount of milk that we actually need if we don't intensively farm. What would be the answer from a Green New Deal perspective to that?
I think the Green New Deal perspective would be that we'd be encouraged to produce less milk and less meat by, for example, having carbon tax that's going to be applied to everything, applied to the methane produced by cows and sheep, for example.
So if I just imagine a future in relation to that, so for instance, we have hazelnut milk in the fridge.
Yeah.
Hazels grow in Britain. I just love hazelnut milk. You know, I love the taste. It almost has this tiny chocolatey kind of taste to it, but, you know, without sugar. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, absolutely gorgeous. So you could actually say, you know, you don't have to give up milk, cow's milk completely, but, you know, we diversify that you have the possibility of more plant-based milks. You know, there's almond milk, of course, but of course, almonds are not grown here.
Absolutely. Yep.
And as part of the sort of diversification of the land, I noticed that in their deal, they also specifically make mention of expanding hedgerows.
Yeah, in a big way.
And hedgerows are, of course, important because?
As an environment for wildlife and for insect life. And so insect life is important for the crops.
But all of that relies on farmers having security of tenure, security in their, you know, ability to have a living wage. And so as part of the Green New Deal, there's also the whole paragraph around providing farmers a greater security to allow them to invest in sustainable improvements.
Yeah, I think at the moment land is used quite often as a sort of tax haven. So if you buy up lots of land, you can just keep your wealth in the land without paying very much tax on it. They say that they would get rid of that. And that would encourage more tenants and more people coming into farming. And then if you make sure that they can stay on a farm for a long time, it means that they are more likely to be able to grow sustainable crops rather than have to prove themselves every year by earning more than, you know, by earning loads of money. They can invest in the future and say, well, I'm going to be here in 10 years' time, so I'm going to pick up the investment as stuff grows and as I improve the soil on the farm, et cetera, then the farm will produce more and then I'll get more money and think of it that way.
And of course, you know, I know we're going to get to the point where we're going to talk about universal basic income, but just imagine a world where everyone, including also farmers, would get a universal basic income, which would make them much more secure and would allow them to say, okay, we're going to plant more trees on our land. We're going to do less intensive farming. We're going to do much more people-focused food production. We're going to give more people jobs to do more people-focused food production. You know, that would allow them to do that. At the moment, the margins are so small for farmers that they're very, very risk-averse. And we've created this system where they just have to heighten production in order to squeeze out the last productivity, you know, gain in order to make a living.
Yeah.
And the deal mentions this notion of people-focused food production and land management. So there's an assumption that if we have more diverse, more sustainable land use, that it's much more people-focused.
Yeah. So the Greens said that they would produce a land commission, though. They'd have a land commission to invest, to look at the effects of concentrated land ownership on food, farming, housing, local economies, and cultures and livelihoods and so on. And they would really be looking at breaking up huge ownerships of land. Mm. And to do that, partly what would do that is their application of land value tax. So they would be taxing the owners of land, not the people who live in properties on the land.
Right. Okay.
So it was a big, big change to taxation. And that's, I think, we'd come to later on.
One of the core features of our carbon strategy is to plant more trees, and farms are crucially important for that. So how do we create incentives where farmers can be part of the solution towards meeting our targets of planting that number of trees?
I mean, it says in the Green New Deal that they would plant 700 million new trees. So they would aim for 50% of all farms to be engaged in agroforestry as well. And that's, as we said, that be putting in a lot more training, encouragement for people to try that method of farming. The reason that agroforestry is good, this sort of a line of trees in between your crops, is because it helps stop the soil from moving and blowing away when the crops have been taken away from the soil. It stabilizes everything. It also helps with managing water in the soil, and it helps to build up the soil, obviously, because the soil isn't being blown away. And when the soil is built up, then it grows more productively. And also, it stores more carbon.
Mm.
And the more soil there is, the more carbon is in the soil, and the more CO2 is not being released to the atmosphere.
But of course, that's a big ask. You know, 50% of all farms to be engaged in agroforestry, if I would estimate it now, we're below 1% agroforestry.
Probably. So this is by 2030. They are saying, again, that they would provide a lot of training. So they'd pay for the training, they'd pay for people to do the training. There'd be the, as you said, the universal basic income. So
we could have done that all, you know, when we did the furlough scheme. You know, this is exactly what we said. You know, we could have actually used the time and said, yes, we have a furlough scheme, but we're moving into the green economy. Let's put some training in place that whilst people are being furloughed, they can learn new.
We could have done, maybe, but I don't think we could have done, because it's a lot of organization once again. Training people, normally people get trained, you know, in groups, which obviously isn't possible when everybody's socially distancing.
I don't know, universities moved all online.
Yeah, universities moved online, so we can move things online, we could produce, have the training online, hopefully. So
Okay.
Something that could be done, but trying to think of that at the same time as the whole COVID-19 crisis maybe was a bit too much. It's getting different people to think about it, obviously, is the important thing to do.
So there's two points mentioned in the Green New Deal. You know, on the one hand, you know, planting of new trees, more trees in urban areas, apple nut crops for food, new woodlands, and the same in relation to urban food growing, community farms. You know, that suggests also way forward that our towns and cities might actually look quite different and much more greener in the future, that we rather protect the trees. I know, for instance, in Sheffield, in the last few years, there were so many protests because the city wanted to cut down so many trees. And it's so difficult to keep that from happening. But actually, that's exactly what we need. We need many more trees,
mm-hmm.
and not just simply ripping them out, but maintaining them.
And older trees like that are perfect because those are brilliant for providing shade. And we're going to be having much more weather events as a result of global warming that's already taking place. So this is having trees in towns and cities is a huge thing to reduce heat waves and also to deal with water when it, as it falls down very quickly. But trees are great for helping to soak up that water and to prevent it just running away into sewers and so on. So trees are in our communities are really, really vital and important.
Right. And then there's a whole section in the Green New Deal which talks about legislating the right to food and legislating the access to healthy nutritionist locally grown food. And of course, you know, we had various debates in this country about, you know, how much sugar is in products, how much salt is in products, how much basically snack food is available for our children, how good our school meals are. And there's a whole section in here about the legislation to the right to good food.
Yeah, and that everybody should have that. So if you're in a poor area and poor community, you should still be able to get good fresh fruit and veg, which frequently isn't the case in many UK cities at the moment.
Yeah, and we know that, you know, the less money you have, the more you're forced to buy less healthy food.
Yeah.
I said that in a quite convoluted way.
No, I think that's fine because it emphasises the fact that you feel forced to buy more of the rubbish food because you just can't get hold of fresh food. You know, you might want to pay a little bit more, but you can't pay for getting on a bus to go into town to find a place where you'd be able to buy it and then come back on the bus and et cetera.
And of course, you know, we know that even when you go to the supermarket and you want to buy some chicken, you know, the fair trade and the organic chicken is so much more expensive. There is something wrong with that because it creates the health divide. It creates the inequality as well.
Yeah, I think that, yes, but that's the market.
Yeah, but my argument would be that we're in such dire situation that organic should be the norm. There shouldn't be anything else. It should only be fair trade and organic. So at the moment, that's still the exception. You go to an organic food shop, you go to the organic section. And I'm just thinking, hang on, where are we in our climate catastrophe? You know, we're almost at an extinction stage. We just should say fair trade and organic is the norm. Everything else is the exception. Income is the last section.
Yep. And obviously, everybody cares about income, and that's very important. And it's one of the things which has changed. The differential of income has changed enormously over the last 20 or 30 years. And that's led to such an environment of unfairness in the UK that everybody, I think, an enormous amount of people respond to. So this is something that's very important.
And of course, a big section of that is universal basic income,
mm-hmm.
because it would also support all the other things that we've just mentioned in this episode and the other episode. How do we move into a green economy if we have security for everyone, a sort of basic security for everyone? It will be so much easier to move into a different type of economy.
Mm.
And I know that, you know, even the Green Deal New Group made reference to Roosevelt's New Deal at the time, which was when, you know, at the time where there was a big recession, and he just shifted the whole economy to think of it conceptually different, and we need to do the same. And universal basic income is part of that.
Mm-hmm.
And just to mention what the universal basic income system is, as mentioned here in the Green New Deal by the Green Party of England and Wales, it would cover all adult basic needs. It's an unconditional payment, so everyone gets it. Mm-hmm. The people who have work, the people who don't have work.
Yeah, and it's universal because it goes to all residents. So
it's not just citizens, it's residents.
Yes, so people who aren't British, who weren't born in Britain, but who are, you know, living here, they've maybe worked for a while and then
they pay their taxes.
Yeah, so they would also gain UBI.
Yeah.
The amount that's quoted is £89 a week. You could probably just about survive on £89 a week, although they'd want to see it improve a little bit over time, I believe.
Yeah, and I think, you know, when you start something like that, because it's such a big shift from how the economy is structured now, you probably have to be slightly conservative in how you phase that in.
Yeah, I imagine so. Because this £89 would replace all other, most other income-related benefits, and which are means-tested elements, which means that you get rid of the whole business of having to means-test people to then say, no, you can't have it, you can have it, etc., etc. Just everybody gets it. So there's no sort of terrible thing about getting it. There's no terrible thing about not getting it. It's just everybody gets it.
So it simplifies the system, and with it, it saves a lot of money that can actually go to individuals as part of the basic income. So when I was looking into it, it did mention in relation to housing benefits, it did mention that those families relying on housing benefits before the UBI would be introduced would continue to receive the housing benefit in order to cover their rent. So is that just a phasing solution?
I think it is. Yes, I think it is a phasing solution, because they would also be looking at rents, for example. So some places, particularly London, rents can be incredibly high at the moment. And just with £89 a week, you couldn't afford a rent in London. So at the moment, they'd have to have housing benefits. But as those rents are brought down by the different changes in taxation and etc., then that would become more something that could be just incorporated into the UBI.
Hmm.
But I think they were saying that it was those people who presently get housing benefits who would continue to receive housing benefit, not people who in the future need to.
And does it actually mention, I couldn't find a place where it said anything about housing ownership or usership. You know, it mentioned car ownership, that it would has to morph to usership. But in terms of housing, it didn't mention anything.
I think that comes in with the land value taxation,
right.
And the taxation of people. So the land will be taxed rather than the property on the land.
Right.
So instead of, if you own your own land at present, then you'd be paying land value tax. You wouldn't be paying council tax or something like that.
So what's the benefit of that?
The benefit of that is that people then release land. Because if at the moment lots of people are hanging on to massive amounts of land, waiting for it to go up in value, and then they'll sell it.
Because they don't have to pay a tax.
Because they don't have to pay anything, really. Right. They say, well, I'm not earning anything on the land, so, you know, I don't have to pay any tax. Now, or with a land value taxation, they would be charged something like about 1% and a bit, 1.4% of the value of the land. And they have to pay that whether they've got people on the land, whether they don't have anybody on the land, whatever, whether they are using the land to produce something or whether they're not. So it means if they're just sitting around doing nothing with the land, like a lot of people have said that about developers, that they buy up a section of land, they don't do anything with it, they get permission to build, and then they don't build anything because they're waiting for values to go up. So those people would have to pay, and they'd have to pay and pay. And then they'd obviously come to the conclusion, oh, if I'm not going to build, I might as well sell this on to somebody else. Let somebody else build a property there.
Okay.
So that would encourage a lot more building, hopefully.
So that's all the points that I could see from the Green New Deal in the section of income.
Yeah, I think so.
So that was income. So that's the Green New Deal of the Green Party of England Wales, and with the six categories, I don't want to call them pillars, but six sort of categories of energy, housing, transport, industry, forestry and farming, income. So what are the things that you like the most about this Green New Deal?
I think it sort of encompasses pretty much everything, is the idea. So it's not just we're going to plant loads of trees or anything like that. It's trying to think about life from all aspects. And it's a very, very big idea. And they've tried to put in the legwork to approach the whole idea.
So it's like what we discussed right at the beginning of the season. It's environmental as well as social justice. It creates an environmental sustainability through social justice. Sustainability.
Yeah, and it does address those four points that were made by the Green New Deal group which was to tackle the climate emergency, to have a sort of net zero emissions by 2030, to tackle the biodiversity crisis. So all the planting of trees, the hedgerows, et cetera, that was tackling the biodiversity, and recognizing the link between climate and inequality crisis. So the UBI is part of that. The land value taxation in particular, it's the idea that they promised to tax wealth at the same rate as they tax work. At the moment, if you're wealthy and you earn your money from wealth, you're taxed far less than you are if you're working for your money, which is crazy.
Yeah. And I think what I like about it, first of all, I like also the fact that it's a very holistic, thought through and calculated model that could work. You can see that it could work. And that would resolve our climate crisis, you know, so it's not a pie in the sky kind of thing, but it deals holistically with the whole system that's of humans living in a place. So I like that. But if I had to point out one thing which I particularly like is the universal basic income, because it would solve so many issues. You know, how do we care for others? How do we support our aging population? You know, how do our creative sectors work? How can we deal with volunteering? You know, it allows us to shift also into different ways of working, a different kind of industry, as we said, manufacturing for renewables. It's just the solution to so many things.
Absolutely.
We actually now have an opportunity.
And it would require borrowing. You know, the Greens said that they were going to borrow $100 billion a year or $1 trillion over 10 years. But actually, the Conservatives and the Lib Dems borrowed £1 trillion from 2010 to 2020. So, you know, look at how horrible that's been as a decade. And the Greens are promising, well, we would employ lots of people, we'd train up lots of people, we'd make everything very much more local, et cetera, et cetera. So, and it's the same money, and we'd end up with a much more productive, much better place to live in at the end of it.
Right, so shall we leave it at that?
Yep.
What are we going to tackle next week?
So next week we're looking at the Labour Party's Green New Deal.
Ooh.
So we've got a lot of reading to do by next week.
So that's going to be interesting. And maybe they offer something which is not even in the Green Party's Green New Deal. Maybe there's something that...
Yeah, maybe. I
You doubt it.
From what I've looked at, you know, obviously we are biased a little bit, but we'd like to think that if it was better, we'd say it's better.
Right.
But we don't think it is. Sorry.
Right.
Okay, so it's goodbye from me.
So if you enjoyed the show, please do leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or on your favorite podcast player, because it really does help others to find us. And we want more people to find us. Feel free to follow us on Twitter on Dithering on the Edge @DitheringE. Goodbye for now, and have a fabulous week.
Bye.